on this edition of The Self-Publishing Show.
There was no music to hide behind. There was no other band members to hide behind. This is what I was writing, and this was going to be out there for people, and do they care?
Publishing is changing. No more gatekeepers. No more barriers. No one standing between you and your readers. Do you want to make a living from your writing? Join indie bestseller Mark Dawson and first-time author James Blatch as they shine a light on the secrets of self-publishing success. This is The Self-Publishing Show. There's never been a better time to be a writer.
Hello and welcome. It is The Self-Publishing Show with James Blatch.
And Mark Dawson. Hello.
Hello, Mark Dawson. Happy birthday, we should say. It was your birthday as we were recording this a couple of days ago. Did you have a nice day?
I did, yes. As I posted on Facebook, my kids decided to decorate the cake for me with the appropriate number of candles, and I had so many candles it melted the cake. So
yes,
there we are. That made me feel very, very old indeed.
It comes to something when your age is a fire hazard.
It does, yeah. I had to blow the candles out and nearly set my beard on fire. So it was interesting.
What did you get?
I got lots of golf stuff, yes. as you might imagine, golf and cycling. So normally I'm quite hard to buy for, because when I see something I like, I just usually go and buy it, which is terrible if people are trying to get presents for you. But I had actually exercised a little bit of patience and put together a little birthday list of golfing things that would be quite nice. And I ended up, I did quite well. So I was very happy. Now I can't use it for 4 weeks until.
No, we just got going to a second lockdown, and I sent you a golf themed card. Did you get that?
You did. Yes, it was a very good card. Yes, we chuckled at that.
Good. Well, you're 1 year older. How old are you? 46.
47, James.
47. Oh my God, the big one's coming.
Well, 3 years' time.
Do you think we'll be out of lockdown by the time you're 50?
No, probably not.
Oh God, yes. The UK is going back into lockdown on Thursday, the day before this podcast is out for. We're told it's a month, but maybe extended, depending on figures. So I hope things are going okay where you are. We have to grin and bear it. The good news is that lockdown has been good for book sales, no question about that. And we've got I'm going to get Kinga back on from Published Drive in the next few weeks, because they've done a lot of analysis on that COVID sales. It'll be very interesting to see some of this data, plural or singular, I never really know.
You can say those data.
Yes, yeah. I think you can. Sounds wrong. Okay, look, let me welcome to our Patreon fold two new supporters this week. We have Paula Williams from Bramley here in the UK, and Peter Rendell of No Fixed Abode, as they say in magistrates' courts. Thank you, Peter and Paula. They've both been to patreon.com/self-publishing show to support us in our endeavour to bring you news and interviews packed with value and interest every week. What else we've got to talk about? We've got our revised course, so our editing course, which is actually two courses to start off with. The major one is Jenny Nash's a brilliant breakdown of how to revise your book, how to have a structured approach, what you should be looking for, how to complete it. Had some really super praise for it this week. And the standout one for me actually was Imogen Clark. Imogen is a very, very good writer, picked up very early in her writing endeavor by an Amazon imprint, has been in the top 10 in Amazon. And she said this has changed the way that she will be revising books, as it's still something that every author has a different way of doing and don't necessarily feel they're doing it in the best way. So that's really nice to hear, and lots of other praise as well. You can sign up for this course. It's at $197 for a week or two. When's this going out? Probably another 10 days, I guess, something like that. If you go to selfpublishingformula.com/editing, and along bundled into that for that price is also a copy editing course authored by none other than Pro Writing Aid themselves. So yeah, you must be pleased, Mark. We sort of started working with Jenny some time back, and I think people know how good Jenny is from listening to the Book Lab episodes, but it's been very pleasing to have that kind of critical response to the course.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, there's a Facebook group for people in the course, and that is filling up quite nicely. We never really know how these courses will do, but the last few we've released, and we're always very keen to make sure that they're super, super high quality. So everything, you know, it will look great. It'll be something that is pleasurable to learn from. So the bestseller course has done really well with Susie K. Quinn, and it looks like Jenny is on the way to matching that. So it's nice. We have a nice suite, a nice progression of courses for wherever you are in your career now, from the actual writing side of things with the bestseller course to editing to foundation with 101, and then advertising with Ads for Authors. So a nice coverage there. And as you mentioned last week, some little tiny courses coming out soon, bite-sized courses, much, much more keenly priced, coming out soon. We've got one on vellum. I'm going to do one on launching. We've got one on word count and productivity that we're starting to put together. I'd still like to do one on business and that kind of thing, which at some point might be quite interesting. But yeah, we're trying to put out as much new content and valuable content as we can. And it's always lovely to see that authors are enjoying that and getting good value from it.
Yeah. And we should say we still produce lots and lots of material that is free and is also good quality. So our YouTube channel, for instance, we put lots of how-to videos on there, of simple explanations of everyday tasks for authors. We've also got a great course on building your mailing list using Facebook ads, which is still going strong. We'll have to probably give it a little brush up this year, I think. Facebook about to roll out some small, we think, aesthetic changes to Ads Manager. And you can get all those courses. You can see where they all are. Either go to the YouTube channel, which you might be on right now, or go to selfpublishingformula.com/resources, courses, in the drop-down tab. You'll see courses. Talking of Facebook, my Facebook ads account has been shut down again. So I said last week, don't panic. You know, hold the course, takes 2 or 3 days. It actually took 3.5 days last time, and I'm really annoyed, frustrated, I should say. We've taken on a brand new author today. Yesterday was the first day of this brand new author, Kerry, and obviously I'm keen. I've got other campaigns in place. I've been working. I spent the weekend quietly working on the media for it, on the images and the copy. Had my dynamic creative campaign set up, and then suddenly yesterday, you've been suspended. It happened just after a credit card payment. So there seems to be something about the way I am paying with an Amex card. We talked about this before for points.
I'm going to talk
to my rep to see whether that might be it, but I don't see why. Why would it be? Exactly. So I've emailed my rep, and I've obviously done the official response. And last time I just got this, you know, standard apologetic thing saying they're very cautious at the moment, but it was a mistake. You were incorrectly identified and you've been restored. And I guess that's going to happen in 2 days' time from now, but it is frustrating, I know. I should also say you probably get this as well. Quite often I get an email from someone saying that they've got a similar position, and can we reach out to Facebook on their behalf, or can we reach out to Amazon on their behalf? And we always say no to that for good reasons. One is that I don't think it's the correct way to do things. You need to be dealing with your own account, and there's permissions and data issues. Secondly, honestly, our relationship with Facebook and Amazon would just disappear if every time we emailed them, it was on behalf of somebody on our list. So practical terms, we can't do that. But as Mark mentioned last week, it might be a redeeming feature of having a rep. So if you are offered a rep on Facebook or Amazon, worth having that initial call with them and just having them on in your Rolodex, to use an old-fashioned expression, because occasionally that can come into useful. But it's annoying. Mm. How often do your accounts shut down?
Well, touch wood, it's never ever been shut down in, however many 6-7 years since I've been doing this, not once. I don't really know why. I suppose there's a very long history now with quite a lot of money that's gone from the account to Facebook, which might stand it in good stead. But I don't think it makes me immune. I'm sure it could happen to me too. Just hasn't yet. So,
there does seem to be different levels of this suspension. So the last time it happened a couple of weeks ago, I literally was completely locked out. I couldn't access the settings. I couldn't do my dailies. This time I can access all of that. It's just all the campaigns are off, with a note saying only an active campaign, any active account can run campaigns, but at least I can do my dailies. At least I can go in there and change copy and so on. But it seems to be tiered levels of this. But there you go. Mm. It is the election in America tomorrow, as we're speaking, recording this on Monday. So you've all got a new president, hopefully, or there's a big court case going on, one of the two, on Friday. And I'm sort of hoping that is going to make the folks at Facebook relax a little bit on their their shut down an account first and ask questions later attitude they seem to have at the moment. But we'll see.
Yeah, I would hope so. But yeah, it's a frustrating time.
It is. Right. Anything else to mention before we go on to our interview?
No, I don't think so. I think it's business as usual here. I've actually just booked myself in for a haircut. I don't need a haircut, really. But I figured I would need one in the next 4 weeks. So I thought I'd get in there first. So I'm going to shoot off down the road after we've done this and have a trim.
Well, I'm going to go to the golf range tomorrow and today and tomorrow, I think, to try and get some practice. And I've actually ordered for my garden a net, a mat and a bucket of range balls.
Good idea. Yeah, I had a net on my birthday list, but that wasn't one that came along, which is fine. But yeah, I have heard that golf clubs are likely to be reprieved in the next few days, because it is a pretty socially distant sport. I mean, you know, it's you're going to be separated by dozens of feet most of the time. So
yes,
we will see.
The way I play golf, I'm usually off in the woods by myself.
Exactly.
Looking for my ball rather than chatting to somebody. Good. Okay. Well, good luck with that, everybody. Yes, our interview today is Vince Fiorello. I can say his name now. I think I tripped over it a couple of times in the interview. Vince is a really, really interesting guy. I wasn't sure what to make of this interview. I knew who he was. So he was in the rock band Less Than Jake, the ska punk band. I now know quite a lot about the levels of ska punk.
No, you don't.
It's not all madness and two-tone, which it was in my day. It's now gone through these various levels, more sort of Green Day in America, ska punk. However, an ebullient character, full of enthusiasm, very entrepreneurial, very creative, but brilliant at working in collaborative teams. So there's a lot about that, a bit about comic books, and a bit about raising money through unorthodox methods. Well, not unorthodox, but crowdfunding rather than perhaps direct selling.
Prostitution?
No, not that unorthodox, Mark. He's a very upstanding guy. I'm sure that era is behind him. He may have dabbled.
Back in the day.
Back in the day, but this is all above board now. Okay, so look, this is Vince, and then Mark and I will be back for a chat off the back.
This is the Self-Publishing Show. There's never been a better time to be a writer.
Vinny Fiorello. Can I say Fiorello? I've been practicing Fiorello. Fiorello?
Fiorello, is it?
There we go. Okay, a little bit of Italian flair. Thank you so much. A genuine music star joining us on the Self-Publishing Show. You know, we have lots of authors. You've muscled in from the world of music, but we're going to talk about, I think, your entrepreneurialism as much as anything else, but also the comic book side of things, which is an area of great interest to lots of people. We get lots of questions about comic book and can it be a commercial success? I want to explore that a bit with you as well. But I think we need to hear a little bit about you, Vinny. Ska punk band Less Than Jake.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm here in the UK, right? So when I was a kid in the 80s, ska punk, this was on the TV all the time. And you're in Gainesville, Florida. I hadn't quite realized how international people would consider ska, because I do consider it a bit of a British thing, but clearly it's got much bigger legs than I imagined.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that you have to talk about, when you talk about ska and ska punk, you have to always mention the waves of ska and ska punk. So the wave that you're talking about, I would assume, would be English Beat, Madness, Specials, that wave.
Yeah.
The wave that Less Than Jake came. Yeah, the two-tone era. Third wave ska. So for Less Than Jake, we came in with the U.S. version of it, which was in the 90s and added a faster tempo and pop punk to it. So we kind of took the reggae out and pushed in more of, for lack of a better word, Green Day. For a audio check, right?
Yeah.
So it's basically ska music blended with pop punk music, and that was Less Than Jake, Real Big Fish, Mighty Mighty Boss Tones, Save Ferris, Dancehall Crashers, go down the line of it, right?
Yeah, certainly a little bit more rocky. And but do you still have some of the sort of brass band instruments that those early ska bands did?
Absolutely. It was three horns, so sax and trombone, and in earlier recordings it was a baritone sax or two trombones. It all depends.
Okay. Know? All right, so we mustn't talk too much about our pet little music, but we'll explore it a bit. But you fell into rock and roll. You obviously didn't take the advice of your maths teacher and your parents, and you said, I'm going to form a band. And how did that all happen?
You know what? It's a university. So me and Krista Makes, so who I was friends with in high school, in another punk band, we decided that we're going to start another band. He had moved to university. I had moved up right after he did. And we just started playing music. But adding in the ideas and the flavor and the influences of the time, which was Operation Ivy, which was The Clash and Ramones and Green Day and Screeching Weasel. And we always name check the band. There's a punk band from the UK called Snuff. And we name checked that band a lot because they were playing fast punk rock, but they had a trombone. They had no ska, but they did a cover of Do Nothing, which is the Specials had made that song popular. And they did it super fast punk rock, but they had a trombone. Okay. And that really impacted me and Chris to go, we should try blending these musics together. And we were really on the cusp of a musical style, a different, you know? So while it is influenced by the Specials and Madness and things like that, it was a brand new thing that we were doing in the early 90s.
Wow. So you were part of that new wave of not new wave. That's another thing, but that extra wave, additional wave of ska. That's amazing. Yeah. And I'm always interested in the kind of economics of this because lots of people, you know, want to start a band and get together at university. Not everyone actually turns that into a living. So is there a little bit of businessman in there with you as well as being a kind of the rock and roll lifestyle?
I believe in two things. The first thing that I believe in is that if you're going to do something and you're serious about doing it, there's small steps to do to build a foundation that you could stand on and build other things on that, right? And the other thing is I like, you know, being an entrepreneur. I like the idea of if I'm passionate about something, there's a chance that someone else is passionate about it too. So let me figure a way to get it to them.
And obviously a reasonable amount of dedication and hard work. And I imagine some fairly long nights touring, you know, classically piling instruments into a van and driving off somewhere.
Yeah. I mean, there's hard work. It goes without saying when you're talking about building something, you don't build something without putting in the time, the effort, the energy. There's a point where you already know going into something, if you have passion about whatever it is, there's going to be long nights. There's going to be failures more than there is successes. And when there is, then it makes them that much more fulfilling.
Yeah. And all of this goes, talks very much to authors starting up as well and trying to get that business side of things going.
You could be a creative that ignores the business side. And there's very few people that could fall backwards into that and go, hey, I'm successful. I really don't care about the business, but my friend over here does. And he's taking care or she's taking care of everything. Most people who are self-publishing, and that's what we're sort of like, we're here. You have to pay attention to the business. You have to put in the extra work besides the creative end. You have to put in the business end too to understand. I mean, even getting your book onto Amazon or getting it into other places or smaller independent bookstores, you have to, you know, understand wholesale versus retail and net 30, net 60, net 90 to get your money.
Yeah, and there's definitely a bit of hustle involved in all of that. So Vinny, I was reading up a bit about you and it mentions in some of the descriptions of you that even during your Less Than Jake phase, you were starting other businesses, particularly around Gainesville in Florida. So what were they? Were they always artistic endeavors?
I have a toy company still that I put toys out, and that's called Wonderland War. I have a tattoo shop in Gainesville. We have 8 people under employment now. Wow. That's called Wonderland. I have Paper and Plastic, which is puts out vinyl records for other bands, as well as some comic books and as well as some books. But before that, I had another record label that I put out music through called Fuel by Ramen. And I had sold that to at least my half to Warner Brothers. And that the sort of, you know, there's other things that go along with it. I always like to get into it. For Less Than Jake's side of it, for, you know, over two decades was the sole sort of creative director of what the albums looked like and getting the artist and what the merch looked like and things like that. So I always have liked to do that and continue to do those things.
Yeah. And you left Less Than Jake last year?
I did.
Yeah. So that's,
you know, and you can never leave something like that. There's name ownership and there's other things. So you're not leaving. I'm just not touring.
Yeah.
So
okay.
I'm a non-touring member/owner of Less Than Jake.
There you go. It does get a bit complicated, and that some of those
it always does.
Yeah, some of those bands that tour from the sort of 70s and 80s and have to have a slightly different name, Jeff Lynne's ELO, rather than ELO, just because you know all those contracts and stuff and what that meant. But there you go.
Of course.
Okay, so let's talk a bit about your latest venture. I mean, I don't know how long ago you started with the comic book side of things.
Well, I've done comics before. I've done Perfect Teeth. I've done The Phone Call. I've done Story Song. But this particular project called The Inevitables kind of started, the inspiration of it started years ago, but the actual project started to form last September. So about a year.
Okay. And just describe The Inevitables to us.
Inevitables is a music and comic book project. So there's a full-length record that goes along with a 22-page comic. And basically, that's the beginning of the world of The Inevitables. So while we went to crowdfund that, and that crowdfund was super successful, it was 220% funded.
Wow.
For that. But it's just the beginning. So you'll have different arms, origin stories for those characters, you know, other issues going forward, other music going forward as well. So it's the beginning of a world that meshes the audio and the visual together.
And they're always going to be sold together.
They're always going to be sold together.
That's an interesting move in its own right, because in some ways it's a bit limiting to people who are prepared to buy a record and not necessarily the other way around. You know, and people who just want a comic book, do you think it's a danger they might think, well, why am I buying a record as well?
You know, there's always, you know, comic books aren't immune to technology as well, right? So there's places that you can go read and consume the digital side of it, right? So you have those people who don't want to be bothered by the music can just hit mute or not bother with it. And there's some places, just like we can't really couple on Spotify or on iTunes, Apple Music. We can't couple it there. So there's plenty of places in the digital realm where people can separate themselves. But on the physical form, here's a comic book. That comic book's coming with a vinyl record, most likely. You know, or a flexi disc or anything else that we could put together.
A flexi disc, that takes me back to the front cover of a magazine stuck on there with Stellotape. That was awesome. Absolutely. Quite often bright pink. So tell us about the comic itself then. What what's the theme? Who's it aimed at? What sort of age group?
There's a sentence that goes with the arc, and it's a group of nobodies try to save the world in 40 days. And it's pretty true, right? And it's not a superhero genre. It's more so oddly aligns with the times that we're in, you know, where things seem to be a lot darker than they used to. And potentially there's some insidious forces that are working to make the end happen. And there's these group of individuals that through either divine guidance or just haphazardly find each other, and it leads them together to either help stop the world from ending or maybe help the world end. Who knows? So other than that, it's aimed at all ages. comic, so there's not any real crazy profanity. There's some alcohol and drug use in it, but to be honest with you, that's, you know, it falls well under the parameters of what I would think. You know, anyone, there's no surprises there, is what I should say.
PG-13 type thing, yeah. Because that's actually quite a big decision, isn't it? Because certainly in the comic book, if we include graphic novels as well, you can go to quite an extreme length in all areas, all very benign.
I wrote a comic that was a horror comic, and we haven't. That's probably our third, like our third in the sphere of the people I'm working with. That's the third project that we're going to, and that's very, it's very dark and it's very extreme, as what you're saying. So, you could go anywhere. That's the beautiful thing about art, right? You could, there's no limitations except for the one that you feel, you know, or the one that you feel when other people, you know, read it and go, you know, this is odd. And I've been there before and I've written things before. And when people read it back to me or talk to me about it, I'm like, I really don't want to talk. I don't want, it's good to write it and it's a cathartic sort of awesome, but at the same time, sometimes you don't want to talk about the things that you wrote and you just want them to be and let people kind of take to it as they want to take to it.
I guess that's what pen names are for, right?
Truth. Absolutely.
So in terms of the production of the comic book, I mean, in terms of illustrations, where do they, who's your illustrator?
Well, here's the thing. We decided to go with, because we were crowdfunding, we decided to go with somebody who was going to do character design, and his name is Devin Watson. So when we launched the crowdfunding, we had character design already there and out for people to look at. And then the person who's doing the sequential art, her name is Liana Kangas, who's worked for, you know, a lot of the bigger name comic book publishers.
So, sorry, how does that work, Ren? You have one person designing what the look of the characters, and the other person taking that design and putting it into the sequential frames.
Yeah, but you know, it's crazy because there's a certain point where you can even cut that up even more, right? So you have someone who, we have someone who is did the character design, and then there's another person who did the layout of the sequential frames, and then Liana did the art for the sequential frames, and then there's someone who comes in and does the lettering, and then she'll go back and do the coloring. But you could have a separate colorist if you so choose.
That's quite a production. I mean, it's a production line.
There is a lot of hands that touch comics, for sure. But at the same time, you could be somebody in your bedroom and you do the whole thing, right? In this case, there's a production line. There's multi arms to get it done.
And do you project manage all of that yourself?
Yeah.
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 And in terms of the writing, Vinny, so when you write a comic book, is there you creating a story and then somebody else adapts that into the speech bubbles and text, or do you write it in that form to start off with?
No, you're right on the first one. So on the Inevitables, it was myself, the co-creator, Obi Fernandez, and then we took that and then the story, the ideas for the story, to a scriptwriter, Jonathan Diener. And he puts it into the dialogue and kind of where it has to happen in the script.
This is quite a collaboration, isn't it? Every time we talk about a different area, somebody else comes in and helps as part of that whole.
Well, that's the whole thing about what we're doing on the Inevitable side. It's a massive artistic co-op, so to speak, right? So I think when you're talking about the music side of it, there was 8 people that played together. And then there was, I don't even know how many on the comic side, but you start to figure production, the people who touch it for production, the people who are the graphic designers that have helped out. We're hitting, I think, that 18 or 19 people that are involved.
Yeah. Wow. And so you started off with the idea. At what point did you think crowdfunding was going to be your route?
You know what? I didn't think of it. Usually, I would never go that route. Usually I would go, okay, here's the budget. It costs 20 grand and we'll find the money and go do it. And a friend of mine who crowdfunded for an independent movie that he was doing, I went, wow. The lead up to it was the most interesting. It wasn't the money that he got that was made sense. It was the lead up and the constant marketing from nothing to 100 miles an hour, right? That I found intriguing. Wow. And that's what led me more down the road, that it's great to have the money to manufacture. But what I thought was great, that you started with an idea and you talked about the idea and you marketed the idea every day and sometimes every hour of the day until the crowdfunding that was done, right? Until, oh, it's the 19 days or the 30 days or the 40 days in this case of the idea of the Kickstarter when it was the campaign was over. So for me, I that's the intriguing thing of being able to market something, talk about it, and get fans as things progressed.
Yeah. So, that's the beauty of, I guess, of a successful crowdfunding project. You end up with the money, but also this fan base that feels more than just fans. They feel invested, literally,
and
in the project.
And they did, yeah. And I think that was the beautiful thing. And that's the thing that really attracted me to do that, right? And again, there's other projects. I had just released a book of short stories. June 24th is when it came out, and I didn't crowdfund that. I did it, and it was a very insular thing for me. I put it out and did everything else that needed to happen, and it's out in the world now, you know, via Audible and Amazon and wherever else, right? But there's other things that are bigger than this singular self, and you need people who have expertise in that, and you go to them. And in the idea of the crowdfunding, I mean, we brought in two other people who were familiar with crowdfunding to help us along, because there's so many arms to it, right? So it definitely provided us with a fan base. It taught us what works and what doesn't work in marketing. And at the end, it was a successful Kickstarter, but I feel that we now have fans for the world that we're going to progress with that are not going to be crowdfunded.
And that base is valuable because, of course, they become your ambassadors, right, to other people to evangelize the project.
100%. I feel that's what happened during the crowdfunding.
You mentioned Kickstarter, so I'm assuming that's the platform you use, the actual Kickstarter platform. Were you happy with that? Was it a good choice? Because there are a couple of options now.
Yeah, I was very pleased with it, but you could do Indiegogo, right? And there's other things, but Kickstarter for us is what made sense. I like the idea of it gets funded or the project dies. And I like that, like, sort of tightrope.
Good motivation.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. And so having concluded the fundraising phase, obviously part of the project is then to deliver what you've promised to those who've invested. And in terms of the maths, how does that work out? Because it's going to cost you a certain amount to deliver what mm-hmm. people have paid for. Is there money left over in terms of profit, or has that then become the foundation for selling it and going into profit?
Well, I'll go with you that at the end of the day, we're not there yet of the what it's going to take exactly to manufacture everything. We did a budget early on and we pin everything. You know, we decided, okay, this is the most, in the worst case scenario, this is the most it could ever cost is this. So we did a budget on a maximum, maximum price, right? For everything. So we're in the manufacturing stages this week, actually, where the music's done, so it's going to go, and the art for the vinyl record's done, so it's going to go to the pressing plant. The art for the label and the music's done for the flexi disc, so that's going to go to the plant and start. Stickers are going to get purchased. Mailing, you know, mailing envelopes and boxes and everything are to get purchased to do the fulfillment. So at the end of it, when there is profit, and there should be, unless there's a catastrophic, I'll knock on wood, but unless there is a catastrophic, like, sort of delay or something happens that we need to start over on something, there'll be profit, but we're using that as a cornerstone to continue the Inevitables world in different releases that we have actually still planned for 2020 and going all the way into the summer of 2021.
Wow. And where else are you going to sell it?
Well, I mean, comic book shops, obviously, but we're going to do it a little bit different. We're going to do it via, I have distribution for vinyl records. So we're going to kind of like backdoor it into those places. And Comixology is a digital place where you can kind of go into it. It's kind of like a Netflix or a Spotify, but for comics. So it'll be available there, and it might not be in your local comic shop, but it most definitely is available for them to order it in. That's number one. Or you could buy it through our web store, which will do the fulfillment for ourselves to do that.
What about Amazon or one of the big the online retailers? Is it?
You know what? It's not going to get there right out of the gate. We'll see when time comes. Amazon, for me, I can appreciate it for what it is, but I've never had, it's never been the thing that for me was front-facing that I made money or felt like I gained any ground by just pouring myself into it. There's other writers that I know that do books that only rely on Amazon as their front-facing page. For me, there just seems there's too much there, and I never felt as an artist or as a business that I ever gained ground by only doing Amazon. It's a very small part in a much larger picture for distribution.
Yeah. And what about the short stories though? Were they done physically or electronically? Or?
Both. Okay. So 619 is available through Amazon, is available through, you know, Apple in their bookstore. Physically, you can get it through Amazon. Physically, you could get it through the website that I have set up for it, right? But it's one of those things that was my first foray into, okay, I'm doing a book, here it is. And it's odd because 619 for me, I was in the middle of writing a novel and around 200 pages in, and I got like kind of frozen in that moment going, is anyone really going to, the people who know me as a lyricist or know me as in other things, are they even going to care? I'm 200 pages in. Are people going to care about what I'm doing right now? And I felt that it was such a big project that there was no end in sight. It was a constant revision. It was a constant like sort of idea. Maybe I should do this. Maybe I shouldn't do that. And it was a very insulated idea for me. And I went, what are you going to do? So I stopped that. And June of last year, I decided I was going to do a short story a day for all of June. So that's what I did. And that 619 represents last summer.
Okay.
All of June, a short story a day.
Was that 30 short stories then? Okay, I can count. I mean, that's interesting hearing you talk about, because a lyricist, I mean, lyrics, best case scenario, cover two pages. To go from that being your art form to a novel, I can see is a transition.
I was 200 pages in and went, I don't know if anyone's going to care about what I'm doing right here.
Do you know, we all think that writing books.
Yeah, I know, you know.
Charles Dickens probably thought it.
Yeah, you would think that anytime that you're putting yourself out there, even in music, it's the same. You're putting yourself out there and you don't know, there's nothing to hide behind. And that was my issue. I think down below that there was no music to hide behind. There was no other band members to hide behind. This is what I was writing, and this is going to be out there for people. And do they care? Do they care to read it? Do they care what I'm writing about? And I kind of tripped out for a second, but that exercise of writing a short story a day, starting it and completing it, that gave me the confidence to kind of push on into it after it was done.
Yeah. Oh, good. And that does sort of raise the whole thing, the tension between doing something for you, because it's a bit of art that you like and you don't really care whether other people like it or not, which is not a bad approach to creating art, right? Sure. But there's also, you know, when you're in the band thinking, what do they want? You know, how do we all, so there's a balance there, is there, right?
Yeah, of course. I mean, there's always in the back of my mind, I programmed myself to go, I have to consider the audience, yeah, no matter what, right? So music, you can sit here around a campfire outside and not give a shit what anyone else has to think about it. And you can fumble along doing whatever. But ultimately, 21 years into being a band, I've trained myself to consider the audience. And instead of just writing and being done and being fulfilled myself, I started to kind of second guess what the audience wants, what the audience is going to think. And it got to the point for me that I had to stop and reexamine the headspace that I was in and kind of untangle some knots that I put there for 2 decades.
Right. An interesting process, isn't it?
It was very cool. And I enjoyed that every day. I had to do this, you yeah. know, I would wake up and I would have some notes, and it kind of, for me at the end of it, became a cathartic thing. And I peeled away some layers of me being bummed for a lot of other reasons. And it was cool. It was a nice therapy yeah. session via short stories and with a background of southern backroads of southern Florida.
There you go. Well, a lot of art does come often from a painful place, right? It has to, some experience goes into it, and it's all the better for it usually when there's a little bit of something in there, right?
You know what? I talked to my wife about it, and I went, you know what? If I didn't create, I wonder about the person that I would be now, mm-hmm. because creating and kind of training myself to kind of dive deep and pull some stuff out and kind of expose it made me like an emotional person, you know, made me have the peaks and valleys of the, you know, being very happy and not very sad, but very sullen and kind of introspective. And I wonder that if I never created, who would I be now? Because I, again, train myself to go deep and dig out what is there and push it out on the table for people to kind of look at it and examine, you know, yeah. through lyrics or through, you know, 619 or the backstory of what the Inevitables is. People look at it and go, man, who hurt you? Like, yeah, who did this? But I don't know. But that's, I agree with you. I feel good art comes from that place, that you got to dive deep to pull it out, man, and show people and go, this is what it is. And there's some times where you go, you're not alone in that idea, you know? And there's people that walk around in the world and go, no one feels like this. No one understands what I'm feeling. And that may seem so contrived, but it's honestly true. There's a lot of loneliness that people feel out there and very singular. And when you write and you kind of push it out and you pull it out for people to read or listen to or whatever, it hits that nerve and people feel this communal, I'm not alone. And you know, I'm not going to say it heals. Sometimes it does, but not always. But even if it's, yeah, you're not alone and you being sad or hurt or depressed or happy, that's the righteous part of creating, in my opinion.
Yeah, well said. I think there are probably hundreds, possibly thousands of people listening who nodding along to that, knowing that their art comes from there and the feeling that kind of therapeutic benefit of it as well. It's a good thing to do. In fact, I think it is probably, I'm sure it is used as therapy for people who wouldn't necessarily have thought to start writing. They're often encouraged to do so for that very reason. So yeah.
You know, I a friend of mine who does a podcast with me, he said, hey, for 619, we should do a podcast because they're short stories, but they have a broader, sort of outlook on it. And I went, okay. We wound up doing 10 hours of recording, and it very much focuses on mental health. And so it turned into a short stories book is going to turn into a 10 hour podcast about, and it's mostly about mental health, about the writing in the book, and you're peeling out these stories about family and about friends and about how I grew up and lived my life. But it most definitely served as those mental health, like help and things. So 10 hours, that happens top of October, we're going to release it. Yeah. So
that's a great thing to do, to have a podcast specifically that goes along with a series of books, or in this case, in a series of short stories. That's a lovely way of turning a reader into a fan if they hear your voice analyzing. Is the idea they've read the short story, then listen to the discussion?
Well, we're also going to play the short story first, the audio version of it. The most that the short story, is like a 15 minute like read, a 10 minute read. Some of them are even shorter than that. So we're going to play that first, talk about it, and then go down the line of 30 short stories. So if you've never listened or read the book, you could still tune in and kind of follow along and digest it all as it goes down.
Yeah. Of course, that is giving away the story for free. But then if people like it, they'll probably buy it anyway.
I think that there's two headspaces. I like the fact that it could go out there and anyone, it doesn't matter, can digest it and be a part. But for me, I think that even the free aspect of it turns people into fans later. And that would put by the novel or the comic book or a record or whatever it is. So I'd rather people become fans than get, 20% of whatever for the audiobook.
Yeah. Yeah. So having done the short stories, did you then go back into the novel? Having found confidence?
I did. I'm done, but October is going to be the month for like a second revision on it. And then I'll send it to an editor to kind of go, what are you talking about? Yeah.
This is amazing.
Or this is amazing, but I have a feeling I like got lost somewhere around like the mid hundreds, and I finally like returned, but there's a gray area in there. I think
that's what editors are for. That's a pretty good start. I can't remember who it was, possibly Stephen King, who said every writer should think that if you don't think your first draft is shit, you haven't done it right. Yeah. So that's what first draft, and we all think that. Yeah. There you go.
That's where I'm at with it.
So just circling back to the comic books, which I think is an interesting area, and it is something that's definitely on the up a little bit at the moment. We've had a couple of people on the podcast or on the show about it, but we do get asked a lot about it. In terms of, you've got a physical product to sell here, which does create a different world from those of us who are pushing ebooks most of the time, with sort of print on demand easily done as a spin-off from that. I mean, for instance, international distribution, is that something, could I find it somewhere in the UK?
You will be, yes. But it'll be the first quarter of 2021. So you see, coronavirus for me, usually I would go and go over to the UK and sit in front of a table of gentlemen that would decide whether they want to distribute this or not, right? But working from home and other things like that, it put maybe like a 3 or 4 month delay on the distribution side internationally onto Inevitables. Yes, you could, if you want it, there's digital parts that you could get it and read it or listen to it. If you want the physical side and you want to mail order it, I could do international, and that's set up to do it that way as well. But to walk into an HMV or a Forbidden Planet or something, it's going to take a hot second, but it'll be in the first quarter of 2021.
Yeah. And that's what the dog thinks. Okay, well, you could tell the dog we're wrapping up because it seems impatient for something. So what's next? I mean, I have to say, The Inevitables as an idea sounds very filmable. There must be some interest at this stage, or?
Yeah, of course. You know, I think that that's why we're calling it The World, right? It's Inevitables World. It's not just this flat 2D thing. We're actually in the process of doing an animated music video for it, for one of the songs, and that'll be out in November. But there is, for us, there is a moment that we're writing and we're sort of pushing into a larger picture for the future. I film or a series, obviously, that's what, you know, would be the finish line and the end goal. Will it get there? I have no idea, you know, but that's the end goal for sure in creating this larger world that we're pushing into.
Superb. Well, Vinny, thank you so much for sharing with us. And I think I really enjoyed it. And I kind of really want you to be successful with this Inevitable. I want this to be a household thing in the end.
So do I.
Because it sounds like it's such a great artistic collaboration and effort. That has good art. As you say, occasionally it's one person. That's it. That's my thing. But it always seems to me a great thing when people work together to create something.
You know what? For me, and it'll be the last, you know, kind of like my wrap up, I think that the best art, it has a team behind it.
Yeah.
You know, I think it could only, you know, the creation of it could be the singular thing, but to really uplift it and to really like get it to the point of people just enjoying the fuck out of it and being available everywhere, I think that's always the sign of good team behind a good idea.
Yeah.
We'll make it a great idea.
Brilliant. So, thank you from Gainesville in Florida. Now, I've got a feeling, is Gainesville like Leonard Skinner territory? Did they come from around there? Was that somewhere else in Florida?
That was Jacksonville, Florida.
Oh, Jacksonville.
Sir.
There you go. Sorry, it's all the same to me. It's so many far away.
And it's all the same to me, too. I'm from New Jersey. So.
Oh, you are? Okay, you just settled down there.
Yeah.
Snowbird as you are. Okay. Well, brilliant. I've thoroughly enjoyed it. I think you can walk the dog now. Vinny, thank you so much for being on the show. And let's stay in touch.
Absolutely. Thank you.
This is The Self-Publishing Show. There's never been a better time to be a writer.
There you go, Vince Fiorello. What a lovely guy. Really fun to talk to him. You know, somebody who just never stops, a bit of a dynamo. You have to read his Wikipedia entry, actually, as well. It does talk about his entrepreneurial spirit. He started a lot of companies over the years. And just goes to show, it's a big growing sector, self-publishing, whatever, whether it's, you know, music, whether it's comic books, novels, nonfiction, and there are myriad different ways to do it. He's very collaborative. How's your collaboration side going? You were writing with somebody, weren't you? You'd recruited somebody at one point.
Yeah, a kid's book. Yeah, so we've got a writer called Alan Burrows is written one book, and we're just editing that together at the moment. And he's about 15,000 to 20,000 words into a second book, so hoping to get that out for Christmas. And we're going to do that through KDP, and then in the new year, perhaps look at something a little bit different to get it into some stores. So that's been great. I mean, Alan is great to work with, good writer. I've had very little need to kind of oversee that in any kind of particularly onerous context. He's done a really good job on that. And we've got Stuart Bache on board on that as well. So, you know, doing a cover, he's done some illustrations for us. He's going to do a nice map inside the book. So yeah, that's been a fun project. I'm quite happy to kind of let Alan run with that. And my view is kind of strategic, and thinking about how we can actually, monetize, I hate that word, but in order to, you know, make some money from that
make it commercial.
That's the plan.
Because, well, fancy having a stab at some sort of collaborative writing one day. I think that'd be quite fun, and also a way of keeping you focused and dedicated to the writing task, which I have to really sort of put effort in. I've been doing every day for a while now, but it does take, in my particular job, it takes some effort every day to make sure that happens. I guess if you've got that external, I did join a little private Facebook group last week, which was set up, and posted my word count in there. That sort of thing helps me. Just, you know, we all have our different ways, don't we, of getting there.
Well, we can try shame.
Yeah, cross-shaming me, yeah.
I've tried the carrot. That hasn't worked, so clearly I need to try the stick.
I think
at the end of every podcast, we'll have a James's word count. And if it's less than 5,000 words a week, we will publicly humiliate you in a kind of Game of Thrones.
26,000 words into the rewrite out of the original 197,000.
So when you say, are you rewriting it completely from scratch?
No, I'm taking each scene, reading it through, deciding on the basis of what we've discussed and what we're doing, whether the scene needs to be there, first of all, and if it does, what form it takes, and then editing it, which is probably, I would say, at the moment, 50 to 75% rewriting.
Goodness. Okay. Well, yeah, fair enough.
One of the problems is that I'm slightly better writer than I was each time I write, and I had before.
That would always be true.
Yeah.
I'm a better writer book to book, but it doesn't mean I rewrite every book. I'm not going to say anything.
You're lazy. That's the only problem.
I am clearly very lazy, and I won't say too much about what you're doing because I don't want to discourage you. I don't think it's a bad idea, but I also think at some point you can't keep rewriting it.
I've got a deadline, end of January, January 31st. I've done my sums. I will have to up my game a bit on where I am at the moment, doing an hour a day or so, probably 2,000, some between 1,500 to 2,000 words a day. I need to up my game a bit to make that deadline, but I will at some point be able to get there. I'm leaving it a little bit longer to work out what the ratio of old words to new words is. At the moment, I think the book's panning out to be about 130,000 words.
Yeah, that's about right. I would estimate for that kind of book. Sounds about right to me. But goodness me, so this is the 251st or 252nd, I don't know, episode of the podcast. And, you know, we were talking about this 250 episodes ago. And yet, I saw a nice comment the other day. Someone in an email to us was asking about your book and how they were looking forward to buying it. And I thought, I know what it was. Someone actually, because you're the guinea pig in the editing course.
Yes.
And someone said that, you know, I want to buy James's book after hearing about it, the kind of process you'd gone through with Jenny to improve the book. And they were very keen to buy it and support you. But they can't do that because
it's not for sale.
Because you're still writing it. You're basically James Joyce. This is going to turn out to be like, this is your Ulysses.
Or To Kill a Mockingbird, was that the...
Salinger only wrote... Catch in the Rye.
Catch in the Rye, yeah.
Salinger only
Harper
wrote...
Harper Lee only wrote one book, and then I think she published the
Two wrote two.
She wrote two.
Right. Two books, yeah. Well, and some stuff that wasn't published. But, you know, Salinger is famous for only writing Catch in the Rye. But, I mean, he is ahead of you.
Yeah. He's ahead of me in many ways. Okay, enough blatch beating. I am on it at the moment and enjoying the process. So far, it's been rewrite, trim, along these lines. The problem is the scene I did yesterday, I did change something. That's where it's going to get tricky and is going to become drawn out and complicated. And I'm trying to avoid that because he has told me the story's fine. The problem is that it's now a pacier book. And so I don't think it just feels a bit unrealistic he would have got to this stage so quickly. So that's an unexpected aspect of it, but I'm hoping to avoid that sort of rewrite because that would really put things back. We could be talking 2023 if that happens.
What happens first, the end of the virus or your book published?
Yeah, there you go.
At the moment, I'm not sure where to put my money on at the moment. I think
no,
we'll see.
Anyway, I did say that's enough of batching for now.
No.
Good. Okay. Thank you very much indeed, Mark. Thank you very much for all your support for my writing. I very much appreciate it. It does keep me going. And there will be a book at some point for people to read if they're interested. Yes. Great. Thank you. That's it for this week. We have more to come next week. Don't forget, you can sign up for the discount period for the editing course if you go to selfpublishingformula.com/editing. And that's got a few days left to run. That's it for me. All that remains for me to say is that it's a goodbye from him.
And a goodbye from me. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Get show notes, the podcast archive, and free resources to boost your writing career at selfpublishingshow.com.
Join our thriving Facebook group at selfpublishingshow.com/Facebook. Support the show at patreon.com/selfpublishingshow. And join us next week for more help and inspiration so that you can make your mark as a successful indie author. Publishing is changing, so get your words into the world and join the revolution with the Self-Publishing Show.